make way for the king. That's where we're at, particularly if you're visiting with us. We want to kind of bring you up to speed to where we're at. The Gospel of Matthew is written under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit by a human author called Matthew. Matthew was a tax collector. He's also sometimes known as Levi. And so he writes this as one that's been radically transformed by Christ. One day he was sitting at his tax gathering booth, and the next day Jesus came and said to Matthew, "Matthew, come and follow me." And so he left his booth, he left everything, he left his friends and his family to follow Christ. And the big thing then we've sort of exposed from Matthew's teaching is this theme of making way for the king. This letter was written primarily to a Jewish audience who were looking for the Messiah. They were looking for someone who would come and be the king of a political kingdom. But no. When Jesus came, he came to be the kingdom over people's hearts and minds and wills and souls and emotions. We saw last week that Jesus was teaching the disciples and the crowds through parables about what it means to be part of this kingdom in which he rules and reigns as king over people's hearts. And now we find ourselves in Matthew chapter 14. So if you've got your Bible, let's turn there. It's on page 981 in the church Bibles. Jesus has just heard the news about John the Baptist being beheaded. He has just fed the 5,000. The crowds are in a hysteria about what Jesus is doing. And now he performs this amazing miracle just after performing such an astounding miracle. Verse 22. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. And after he dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone, but the boat was at already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. And during the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them, being his disciples, walking on the lake. And when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of his boat, walked in the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. And then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Truly, you are the Son of God. I read a quote this week written by a guy called William Shedo. And he said this: "A ship in the harbor is safe, but that is not what ships are built for. A ship in the harbor is safe, but that's not what ships are built for." And it got me thinking about what it means to be a disciple or to be a learner or to be a pupil or to be a follower of Jesus Christ. You see, we can be very safe in the harbor. Matthew was quite safe at his tax collecting booth. Peter was quite safe as he sort of owned his fishing business. But now that they've been called to be a disciple, they could be safe in their own lives and safe in their own existence. But Jesus hadn't called them to live a safe life. He called them to go on a great mission. And so too the disciple in 2014. We can be safe in our own existence, but that's not what Christ has called us to. He's called us to a mission to go to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the very ends of the earth, or to the utmost parts of the earth. We've been built to go and make damage against the gates of hell itself. We've been built to go and follow in the dust of a rabbi and a teacher, Jesus Christ, who said, "If anyone wants to come after me, he must deny himself, pick up his own cross daily, and follow me. For if anyone wishes to find his life, he will lose it for me and my gospel," or me and my mission. So are we safe this morning? Because what we're going to find is that the disciples, now that they're going to follow Christ, they're going to go out into the midst of one of the biggest storms they've ever seen in their lives. A year or two ago, we covered this in Mark's Gospel, in Mark chapter 6, in a short account, where they are amazed at what Jesus will do this morning. We covered in Matthew chapter 8, just skimmed over it a couple of weeks ago, where the disciples were in another type of storm, but the difference was Jesus was in the boat. They had their eyes fixed on him. He was sitting there. He was with them. And Jesus calmed the storm. But this morning, Jesus is nowhere to be found. And so let's drop down into Matthew chapter 14, verse 22. The first thing we need to see is this. Let Jesus send you into a storm. Because we're going to have three truths coming out of this passage to help us survive a storm. That's the big question. How do we survive a storm? In the political process in Northern Ireland, there are politicians, both here and across the water, who are running round and scurrying, trying to find out a solution to a political storm. Who will they look to? To De Haas? Will they look to the First Minister? Will they look to the Prime Minister? Who's going to solve the storm in our political crisis? And so the disciples were asking a very similar question. Who's going to solve this problem? Here we are in the middle of a storm. Who's going to solve it? Firstly, let Jesus send you into a storm. Sounds crazy, doesn't it? But you see, because Jesus has asked his followers to follow him, and of which he's going to be king of their lives, they've got to surrender their way to him. Surrender their lives to him. And so they have to let Jesus send them into the storm. Look what it says, verse 22. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. This was so amazing because Jesus has just fed the 5,000. The disciples who have walked with Jesus for a number of months, perhaps a couple of years at this point in the gospel narrative, have seen Jesus wow the crowd. 5,000 men and perhaps up to 20,000, including men, women and children, were fed. The folks were looking for a political king. And here is Jesus, this radical teacher, this rabbi who's saying, look, what I can do with all these loaves and these little pieces of fish. This was a miracle working king. This is the guy the disciples are now starting to plan their position in this political kingdom. And what does Jesus say? He says, go out into the boat. Ah, but hold on, Jesus, we've got the crowd whipped up into a frenzy. We can now go. We can march against Jerusalem. We can do this thing, Jesus. It's all starting to fall into place. And Jesus says, get into the boat. You can imagine the looks, perhaps like the look you give to your boss when they ask you to do something wacko and you know it's all going to work out terribly. And they're looking at Jesus, I believe, and they just don't get it. They don't understand. And so the folks are left with Jesus. And the disciples are now going out into the storm of their lives. Then verse 24. But the boat was already a considerable distance from the land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. So there's two pictures that we need to see this morning in this particular part of the passage. Jesus is now up on a mountainside in a desolate place alone with his Father. You see this time and time again in the gospel narrative where Jesus has to get alone with God. Why? Because his Abba Father, God the Father, was the only one that could understand Jesus. And more than anything else, Jesus was leaving you and I an example that we are to find our source of strength and nourishment and power in our lives, in our relationship with God. He wanted to go and have an encounter with his Father before he would move on to the next part of his ministry journey. And so he wants to get alone with his Father. He could have marched the political kingdom against Jerusalem. He's just fed the 5,000. He's whipped up the crowds and he says, I want to get alone with God. Then the question comes to us, when was the last time we were alone with God? Sometimes if you're like me, the times when I go to God is when I'm in the storm. Jesus has just perhaps had the highlight of his ministry so far. And he goes to his Father after the joy. Perhaps he wanted to share in the Father's joy about what has just happened. So we see Jesus up on a mountainside alone praying. He's just sent his disciples out into the storm of their lives. And you say, has Jesus forgotten about them? Well, Mark chapter 6, verse 47, which we read a couple of years ago, said this. When evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, and he was alone on the land, being Jesus. And he saw the disciples straining at the oars because the wind was against them. So here is Jesus up on this mountainside. John in John chapter 6 tells us that the disciples had rowed many stadia, that means about 3.5 miles from the shore. And it's not that wide, the shore. It's about 5 miles wide, the Sea of Galilee. And so they've rowed 3.5 hours in the buffeting wind and waves, in the storm of their life. But Jesus has never taken his eyes off them. And as I was reading that this week, sometimes in our lives, when we can't see Jesus, Jesus still sees us. If you're in a storm this week, if you've been in storm the last 6 months or the last number of years, and it feels as if Jesus has gone off the Richter scale, you may not be able to see him, but he still sees you. He's got the eyes of an omnipresent, someone who's always present. He's got the eyes of someone who's omnipotent. That means he's all powerful. And so here are the disciples 3.5 miles out from the shore, buffeted by the wind and the waves. And you can imagine them talking, why did Jesus do this? What's this all about? What is God doing? Why has he given me this plan for my life? Here we're going to die in the very place that we know like the back of our hands. It's our place of business for many of them. 7 out of the 12 disciples were fishermen by trade. Jesus knew their storm was coming. He let them go out into the middle of the storm. But it seems to me, and from the testimony of many godly people many years ahead of me, they often say to me, Johnny, God has taught me more in the storm than he's ever taught me at the seashore. And so Jesus had to send them out into the storm. They would have been safe in the harbor, but the boat wasn't made to sit in the harbor. It was made to go out in the sea. And so he's going to teach his disciples what it means to live by faith. And how to survive a storm. But does Jesus leave them alone? These disciples who are exhausted, downcast, weather-beaten. But then secondly, not only let Jesus send you into the storm, but let Jesus come. Let Jesus come to you in his timing. That's the crucial point in this. Let Jesus come to you in his timing. The Bible says that his timing is perfect. But I would also like the Bible to say, his timing is terribly frustrating. I sit with people. I look at my own family's life at times and I go, Lord, your timing is perfect. But as this storm wages all around us, why don't you just come now? This would be a really good time. We're in the middle of the storm of our lives, God. What are you doing? His timing's perfect. His ways are not our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. But look what it says, verse 25. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. Now in Roman culture, they split times a little bit differently to you and I. They had what was regarded as four segments. 6 p.m. at night to 9 p.m. at night was the first watch. 9 p.m. to 12 p.m. was the second watch. 12 a.m. to 3 a.m. was the third watch. And then the fourth watch, the last watch of the night, was 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. And we reckon that the disciples went out around the first watch of the night. They've been in the storm of their lives. They've been buffeted by the wind and the waves. You can imagine what it must have been like in the middle of that boat. And Peter must have been going mental, if they used the word back then. And Jesus didn't come on the first watch. Maybe he'll come on the second watch. Surely he'll come on the third watch. But no, he came on the fourth. And the amazing thing is the fourth watch is the darkest part of the night. It seems to me, as again, and I sit with others and I watch at times, it seems as if Jesus waits at times to come at the darkest point. When the disciples perhaps had
thought of every strategy. 7 out of the 12 are fishermen, of how to navigate their way through this storm. They've been in many storms before. But there was this, I believe, was a supernatural storm. And perhaps they've waited and thought, you know, the sea will change during the first watch, and then we'll try this during the second watch, and then during the third watch. And perhaps they had exhausted all human ways of solving this storm. And I believe in the fourth watch they'd given up. Perhaps you feel like that this morning. You've given up on Jesus even coming. You can recognize that he sent you into the storm. You recognize that it was coming. But you've perhaps just given up that he's actually ever going to turn up. And the psalmist struggled with this when he said in Psalm 139, he thought about running away. He thought about losing God. He thought about going somewhere else. And he said in Psalm 139, verse 8, if I go up to the heavens, you're there. If I made my bed in the depths, you're there. If I rise in the wings of the dawn, and if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. And so David, after he wrestled with God in the dark night of the soul, realized that even as if God didn't seem to be there, he was there and he was still working. The disciples had forgotten what Jesus had just taught them. If you look back in Matthew chapter 10, you'll see that he's taught them in verse 29 how much he loves them. Jesus communicated this to them. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than sparrows. That truth would have resonated with their heart, their mind, and their soul. But now when the storm is here, now they're in the fourth watch of the night, no doubt the promises of God and the promises of Jesus have flown off with the wind and the waves, and so they're wondering if God's totally abandoned them. But he hasn't. Look at verse 26 in Matthew 14. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and they cried out in fear. The word that Matthew uses is the word phantasma, meaning it's a ghost, it's a phantom, it's a creature of the imagination. The Jews were land lovers. They didn't like the sea. They didn't want to be caught in the sea in a storm. And if you read into Judaism, you will find that the Jewish popular belief often recounted the appearance of unusual things at the sea. And the Talmud on the New Testament gives several illustrations of what would be regarded as monsters out in the sea. And so they're so wrecked and so beaten that when they see something walking on the sea, they think their night's getting worse and it's now a monster. They cried out in fear. They're shrieking out in fear. They do not realize that it is the Lord. But he's coming to them. He sent them out in the storm. Now coming to them, and then thirdly, let Jesus speak in the eye of the storm. Let Jesus speak in the eye of the storm. Verse 27. But Jesus immediately said to them, take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid. Now we've discovered that this is the darkest part of the night. I believe the disciples have totally given up. I believe they feel that death is imminent, being professional fishermen, many of them. And yet, out of the darkness of the night comes the light of the world. The one who was there at the beginning of time, who created darkness and light, who created the sea and the dry land. And at this particular time of year, around Passover, the Jews, of which there were many in this boat, would have been reciting Passover literature. And part of the Passover literature would have been many things about God being the one who controls the wind and the waves and the sea and the dry land, and he controls things with his powerful hands.
They would have been reading at this time about the Exodus, which we're studying on Sunday nights. About how Moses went to Pharaoh. And before he went there, God said to him, Moses, when you go, tell them that I am has sent me to you. And so when Jesus walks to his disciples in the middle of the night, in the middle of that lake, in the middle of the storm at their hour of greatest need, at the darkest time in the night, and he says, take courage, it is I. It was the same language that was used at the Passover. It was the same language that Moses was to go to Pharaoh and say, I am has sent me to you. They were seeing very much God of very God in the middle of their storm. Take courage. It's God. Don't be afraid. I wonder what difference these words make to your life this morning. When you just start to let Jesus speak. When you start listening to him and not yourself. Paul Tripp, a very helpful writer, says, no one is more influential in your life than you are. No one talks to yourself more than you do. It's weird though when you see people talking to themselves, but thankfully everyone kind of knows now that people have phones in their cars and that they can link it up, and so they don't think you're that wacko. But isn't it true? No one's more influential in your life than you are. But once Jesus starts speaking, the situation may not change, but your perspective may start to change this morning. I wrote this week in my study these words, the night is never too dark. The storm is never too severe. The boat never so frail that it will ever escape the sight of our Abba Father. Your dark is never too dark. Your storm is never too severe. Your boat is never so frail that it will ever escape the eyes of Abba Father. But how's Peter feeling about all this? They think they're going mad, I reckon. Look what he says, verse 28. Lord, Adonai, if it's you, Peter replied, tell me to come to you on the water. Now, some of you will know that Peter's name in the Greek text is the word Cephas, which means the rock. And as we've discovered this morning, rocks aren't always good for staying afloat. But Peter starts to get a glimmer of hope in the middle of the storm. They've exhausted all their human resources. They've tried all of the things in their human strength. And so Peter starts to get his eyes back on Jesus in the middle of the storm. Lord, if it's you, tell me to come to you on the water. Jesus said, verse 29, come. Then think about this miracle. You've maybe read it many times in your life, but try and put yourself in the situation. Then Peter got down out of the boat. Now, this guy's a professional fisherman. Could you imagine? This is where he works his whole life, and so he's suddenly starting to put his foot out onto the lake. There's a storm waging all around him, one like he's never seen before. No doubt it was howling all around him and submerging the boat. And the boat was filling up, no doubt. And Peter is stepping out onto what would mean certain death. Any fisherman would know that. But he's got his eyes on Jesus. And that changed everything. Come, Jesus said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked, and came toward Jesus. Ships are safe in the harbor, but that's not what they were built for. What a lesson of faith Peter is learning this night in the middle of the storm. But like you and me, in the middle of whatever we're facing this morning, it's not always easy to keep our eyes on Jesus. So look what happens in verse 30. But when Peter saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Note it wasn't that it was an attack that was bigger. The text doesn't say that the storm got bigger or that the waves got bigger
or that the situation got worse. Look what the text says. The text says, but when he saw the wind. So Jesus was maybe standing maybe 10, 15, 20 yards away from him. He's walking on the water miraculously, and perhaps his humanness kicks in and he thinks, there's no way we can survive this storm. And so he turns. He sees the wind. And maybe this morning there's a circumstance in your family, in your workplace, with your health. And all you can do in your humanness is look at the wind. You can't see any hope. You can't see any way through the darkness. You can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. And I would encourage you now with what Peter's going to do. He doesn't firstly get his eyes back on Jesus. Look what he says at the end of verse 30. Beginning to sink, and some of you might be feeling like that, and perhaps you're just about to go under. Stretches out a hand. Lord, save me. Perhaps there's a person here this morning who doesn't know Christ. And for the first time in your life, you're putting out your hand to him this morning. You realize you can't do it in your life on your own. You realize the wind and the waves are too much. And for this morning, you're putting out your hand and saying, Lord, would you save me? Would you transform me? Would you turn my life around again? Or there's maybe the Christian here this morning and the wind and the waves of health and family and work and all the pressures, and you're beginning to sink and your eyes are totally off Jesus this morning. Would you cry out, Lord, save me? Would you come to me? And what was Jesus' response? Verse 31. Immediately, this is the third time that Matthew uses the word immediately. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You have little faith, he said. Why did you doubt? And when they climbed into the boat, and I've sort of annoyed at Matthew this week. Sometimes it happens with biblical writers. I want to know what that embrace was like. I mean, Peter is sinking his way to his death. The storm of life is about to go out in his life and he's going to die. And suddenly Jesus has come and he saved him. And I wanted to know about the embrace. I wanted to know what it was like when Jesus picked him up, that he put him on his back, that he put Peter in his arms as they walked back through Peter's very trial, which Jesus is using as a footpath. But there's this compassion of the Abba Father. He saves Peter. He rebukes him for having little faith, for doubting. But then look what happens, verse 32. You'll note that the storm hasn't stopped. The only difference is Jesus is now with Jesus, or Peter is now with Jesus. And it seems in the Bible that for many people, the storm actually doesn't stop in this earth. We've discovered that in our Sunday evening teaching series, that some people are stoned, some people are sawn in two, some people had to walk around in goatskins and sheepskins. Men and women of whom Hebrews 11 tells us the world was not worthy of and didn't receive their promise this side of eternity. But they were looking forward to the reward, whose architect and builder was God. That means in heaven. So for some people, the storm doesn't actually stop in this earth, but actually the intimacy with Jesus can be never stronger than anywhere else. And so Peter, in the midst of the storm, has intimacy like he's never known before. But then verse 32, look what it says. And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. It was almost as if the wind and the waves were spectators to what Jesus was doing. But look back into Matthew chapter 8. If you have your Bibles, as I bring this to a close, which, as I used to say about my dad, meant absolutely nothing. I used to throw the Ten Commandments at him, that it says that you shall not lie, when he would take about 20 minutes to land the plane. Look at Matthew chapter 8 and let's finish with these words and then into the last part of Matthew 14. This was the storm a little bit earlier in the gospel narrative. Matthew 8 verse 23, then Jesus got into the boat and his disciples followed him without warning. A furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was sleeping.
The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us. We're going to drown." Jesus is in the boat. He replied, "You of little faith." Sounds familiar? "Why are you so phobio or afraid?" Then he got up and rebuked the wind and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of a man is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." But flick back with me to Matthew chapter 14. They ask, "What kind of a man is this? That even the wind and the waves obey him." They don't truly understand who Jesus is in the middle of their storm. But look how they finish in Matthew chapter 14, verse 32. "And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat," they didn't say, "What kind of a man is this?" They worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Can I encourage you this morning? Put your eyes back on Jesus. That's how you survive a storm. Let him send you out into it, even though that's difficult. Let him come to you in his timing, even though that's difficult. But let him speak. Let him speak this morning into your life. And let us finish with the words of that great verse in Hebrews chapter 12. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and the perfecter of our faith. You say, "But he never went through a storm like we did." Oh, he went through a bigger one. "Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising its shame." And now the Bible tells us where he is. He's now sat down at the right hand of God the Father. So what are we to do this morning? Consider him who endured such hostility from wicked men. Why? So that we will not grow weary or lose heart.